Two, the Southern Railway offered an excursion to a moonlit walk along the South Downs, expecting to sell 40 or so tickets. 1,500 people turned up. The people setting out on these walks weren't seeking to conquer peaks or test themselves against maps and miles. They were looking for a mystical communion with the land. They walked backwards in time, to an imagined past suffused with magical native glamour, to Merry England or to prehistoric England, pre-industrial visions that offered solace and safety to sorely troubled minds. For though railways and roads and a burgeoning market in countryside books had contributed to this movement, at heart it had grown out of the trauma of the Great War and was flourishing in fear of the next. The critic Jed Estey has described this pastoral craze as one element in a wider movement of national cultural salvage in those years. It was a response to economic disaster, a contracting empire, and totalitarian threats from abroad. It was a movement that celebrated ancient sites and folk traditions. It delighted in Shakespeare and Chaucer, in Druids, in Arthurian legend. It believed that something essential about the nation had been lost and could be returned, if only in the imagination. White, caught up in this conservative antiquarian mood, walked with his hawk and wrote of ghosts, of starry Orion naked and resplendent in the English sky, of all the imaginary lines men and time had drawn upon the landscape. By the fire, his hawk by his side, he brooded on the fate of nations. The cloud base is low today. It does not matter. He is not flying today, he is walking. He is walking with his hawk, and he and Goss have traversed 5 fields to get here. Now he stands by the ruins of the chapel of St. Thomas the Martyr. Once it was a chapel, then it was a house, and now it is a ruin, a great collapsing carcass of stained ironstone. The roof is a broken ribcage heaped with rotting thatch. Lintels sag over windows and doors blocked with laths and limestone rubble. Great banks of nettles grow here, rich and green. Ash trees rise in lacy fists, and the fields fall away each side. It is very quiet. He hears the ticking of a robin somewhere, like falling water. This place is soundly cursed against man, he thinks. The stink of the dead sheep he found dumped in a drain is still caught in his nose, a sorry, sodden wreck of fleece, pullulating with maggots. He does not mind the smell. It is a bracing stench. It is the smell of mortality. He looks down at the rabbit-cropped turf. Beneath him, the people that lived and died and were buried here are here still, he thinks. Their old bones would be grateful to see a goshawk again. He walks around the chapel, imagining the earth beneath him turning and muttering as it senses the familiar hawk above, as the bones of farm labourers mutter when agricultural machinery passes over their forgotten tombs. I thought of the small race now underground, strangers of a vanished species safe from comprehension, almost from imagination, monks, nuns, and the eternal villain. I was as close to them as anybody now, close even to Chaucer, with grey goshawk in hand. They would understand my hawk with their eyes as a farmer understood an elevator. We loved each other. White's visit to Chapel Green was my favourite part of the goshawk when I was young. It was a communion with something lost and forgotten, and somehow a hawk was at the heart of it. It always gave me a sense of kinship with White, although I couldn't imagine why farmers should have a special knowledge of elevators. That made no sense at all. Maybe he meant to write tractor, I thought, for I didn't know then what a bale elevator was, nor that White had been lately watching the wheelers who farmed the land around him using one. But I could imagine the chapel quite clearly when I was small, and now it was clearer than ever. If I shut my eyes, I saw White lifting Goss on his fist and shutting his own eyes very tight, as if it were possible for the whole mess of the 20th century to slip aside, and the world of centuries before be resurrected, a lost community with him at its heart. He would have been loved. He would have been understood. Looking back and all for love. There was a telescope on my bookshelf at the far end of the room, a spotting scope in a green Cordura cover. I'd borrowed it from my father to go birdwatching, and it had not been returned. I'd forgotten to bring it with me on that last visit. "Next time," he said, shaking his head with good-natured exasperation. There was no next time. I could not give it back. I could not apologize to him either. There was a time, perhaps the day after his death, or perhaps the day after that, when I sat on a train with my mother and brother. We were on our way to look for his car. It was a desperate journey. My hands clutched the coarse upholstery of the seat until my knuckles turned white. I remember Budlier and trackside clinker and a green gasometer and Battersea Power Station as the train slowed. And it wasn't until we were standing on Queenstown Road Station, on an unfamiliar platform under a white wooden canopy, wasn't until we were walking towards the exit that I realized for the first time that I would never see my father again. Ever. I stopped dead. And I shouted. I called out loud for him. "Dad!" And then the word "no" came out in one long, collapsing howl. My brother and mother put their arms around me and I them. Brute fact. I would never speak to him again. I would never see him again. We clung to each other, crying for Dad, the man we loved, the quiet man in a suit with a camera on his shoulder, who had set out each day in search of things that were new, who had captured the courses of stars and storms and streets and politicians, who had stopped time by making pictures of the movings of the world. My father, who had gone out to photograph storm-damaged buildings in Battersea on that night when the world had visited him with damage and his heart had given way. The photographs he'd taken were still on the camera they handed to my mother at the hospital. The last photograph I saw only once. I never want to see it again, but I can never stop seeing it. Blurred, taken from a low angle, far too low, an empty London street. Sodium lights, dusk, a wall tipped sideways from the vertical and running into the distance, a vanishing point of sallow, stormy sky. Chapter 12. Outlaws. "Come on, Mabel." I'm kneeling on the carpet and holding out a dead, day-old cockerel chick. My freezer is packed with their sad, fluffy corpses, byproducts of industrial egg production. Mabel loves them. She stares longingly at the one in my glove. I hold it just out of reach and whistle. "You can do it," I say. "Jump." But she is doing everything she can to avoid jumping. It is comical. She leans. She leans further. She stretches her neck as far as it will go and opens her beak hopefully. The food is just there. She can't reach it. She overbalances, scrambles upright. A change in tactics is required. She makes a cobra strike grab for the meat with one great grasping foot. Her reach is astonishing. Her legs are almost as long as she is. One feathered shin flashes out, tawny as a lion's, and her talons very nearly catch on the glove, but not quite. Now she is cross. She paces up and down. She stamps and grips her perch. Her black feathered moustaches harden into frown lines down her jaw, and I can feel her bristling. She snakes her head from side to side, reckoning distances. Something is changing in her. I sense it with a shiver. It is as if the room is darkening, contracting to a point. Then something happens. My hand is hit, hard, with a blow so unexpectedly powerful, the shock is carried down my spine to the tips of my toes. Hitting someone's hand with a baseball bat would have a similar effect. She is on the glove, mantling her great barred wings over it, gripping it fiercely and tearing at the meat. Disarticulated pieces of chicken disappear fast down her throat. I am delighted. She has crossed a great psychological gulf, one far wider than the 10 inches of air between her perch and the glove she's landed upon. Not that she's landed on it. She's killed it. There is no mercy in that ratcheting, numbing grip. Mabel can keep up this pressure with no effort whatsoever. It is an effort for her to let go. I choose my moment. When her head is up, swallowing a mouthful of chick, I tug its remains through my palm and spirit it away. She looks down, then behind her, then at the floor. Where did it go? I persuade her to step back onto her perch. Then I hold the chick out once more, and further away. Instantly I feel that terrible blow. It is a killing blow, but there is something about the force of it that reminds me that I am alive. I was alive, yes, but exhausted. I felt as if I were built of wool, grey, loose-spun wool on an aching set of bones. My walks with the hawk were stressful, requiring endless vigilance, and they were wearing me away. As the hawk became tamer, I was growing wilder. Fear was contagious. It rose unbidden in my heart as people approached us. I was no longer certain if the hawk baited because she was frightened of what she saw, or if terror she felt was mine. And something else had happened on our walks. We had become invisible. The people passing by didn't stop, didn't look, sent not even a sideways glance in our direction. Some part of me began to believe that they didn't see us at all, that we were walking in another dimension, as if we were ghosts, or they were. I thought of those goshawks I'd seen as a child staring out at a winter afternoon from the world I now inhabited. And at night at home I stood at the window watching the lights outside, pressing my forehead against the pane to feel the faint ticking of summer rain through glass and bone. Everyone saw us. Of course they did. A woman stalking the park with a bloody great hawk on her fist and a baleful stare on her face is hardly inconspicuous. Everyone saw us. They just pretended they hadn't. But some people were brave enough to look. The next morning, for example, standing in thin rain, watching flotillas of umbrellas move across the park, I notice a man. He stands against a fence 20 feet away, hands resting equably on the wooden rail, watching us with a face as expressionless as if you were regarding horses in a field. I walk over and say hello. "He is from Kazakhstan," he says. And we talk about my hawk and about Kazakh falconers, Berkutchi, who fly golden eagles from horseback as they have done for thousands of years. He has never seen the eagles, he says, because he lives in a city, in Almaty. He asks if my hawk has a hood. I give it to him. He turns it in his hands, nods at its workmanship, gives it back to me. Only then do we properly introduce ourselves. His name is Kanat. He asks where I will hunt with the hawk. "On farmland, a few miles from here," I reply. He nods, looks searchingly at Mabel, and is silent for a long time. Then he spreads his fingers wide on the wooden rail and stares at the back of his hands and at the cuffs of his brown leather jacket. "I miss my country," he says. Soon after he leaves, a cyclist skids to a halt and asks politely if he can look at the bird. He is absurdly handsome. He stands there with his Antonio Banderas hair and his expensive technical jacket and titanium bike beaded with rain, and admires the hell out of her. "She is beautiful," he says. He is trying to find another word, but it evades him. "Beautiful will have to do," he says it again. Then he thanks me over and over again for the hawk. "So close," he says. "I have never seen a hawk so close." In Mexico, he has only seen wild ones, and only far away. I like to watch them, because they are... And he makes a movement with one hand as if it were something lifting into the air. "Free," I say. He nods, and I do too, and in some wonder, because I'm beginning to see that for some people, A hawk on the hand of a stranger urges confession, urges confidences, lets you speak words about hope and home and heart. And I realize, too, that in all my days of walking with Mabel, the only people who have come up and spoken to us have been outsiders. Children, teenage goths, homeless people, overseas students, travellers, drunks, people on holiday. "We're outsiders now, Mabel," I say, and the thought is not unpleasant. But I feel ashamed of my nation's reticence, its desire to keep walking, to move on, not to comment, not to interrogate, not to take any interest in something peculiar, unusual, in anything that isn't entirely normal. I'm in an expansive, celebratory mood. Today, Mabel flew 4 feet to my fist from the back of a chair in my front room. "You are doing brilliantly," I tell her. "Time for a walk. Let's go meet my friend's kids. They'll love you." A few minutes later, I knock on a door and my friend's husband opens it. My hawk flinches. So do I. This man was exceptionally rude to me once. But whatever. Doesn't matter. Maybe he was having a bad day. Forgive. Forget. My friend isn't in. I stand before the door and tell him about the hawk. I tell him her age, her sex, her species, her name. I tell him that I'd thought her taming would be the kind of agonizing battle I'd read about in The Goshawk. "But it's been a total surprise," I say. "There's been no battle at all. Which isn't my doing, I'm sure. She's a freakishly calm hawk." And the man inclines his head to one side and smiles. "Well," he says, "that'll be a gendered thing." "Gendered?" "Yes. You're a woman, and she's female. Of course you get on," he says. He seems deadly serious. I stare at his curled hand on the doorframe and heat rises in my face. This is mockery. For the first time in weeks, the hawk disappears from my mind as some part of me bunches up into one firm and unspoken sentence. What an asshole. He's saying, because I'm training a female hawk, there's some bond of sisterhood between us. What the hell? We're different species, for God's sake. "I don't think that's a factor in my hawk's behaviour," I say and smile. It's a thin smile, the smile of the placator. It is a smile that is a veneer on murder. I rage my way home, heart beating wildly. Back in the house, hawk on her perch, I collect myself. My anger has gone. Now I am fascinated. I pull all the falconry books off the shelves and pile them up on the floor. Then I sit cross-legged next to the hawk. "Right, Mabel," I say. "Goshawks are boys' birds, are they? Let's see what the boys have said about you." I pick up Humphrey Ap Evans' Falconry for You and read. "She purrs and chirps to her master, rubbing her head against him. But she is proud and wild and beautiful. Her anger is terrible to behold. She can be moody and sulky." Now I open Gilbert Blane, and there I read of her peculiar and somewhat sulky disposition. "She will set her mind on making herself as disagreeable as she can," he explained, "will exasperate you to such a degree that you will long to wring her neck." Then to Frank Illingworth's Falcons and Falconry. "Never was there a more contrary bird than the goss. Her sole purpose in life seems to be to aggravate her owner." "Mabel, this is very dubious," I say. Then I start on the Victorian falconers. Charles Hawkins Fisher did not like her or her kin. And Freeman and Selvin considered it a thousand pities that the temper of this bird is so very far from amiable. It is, in fact, sulky. Sulky? Oh, my God, Mabel, you know what you are. You're a woman. You're a hormonal woman. It made such ghastly sense. It was why these falconers never wondered if their own behaviour had anything to do with why their goshawks took stand in trees or flew into fits of nerves or rage or attacked their dogs or decided to fly away. It wasn't their fault. Like women, goshawks were inexplicable, sulky, flighty and hysterical. Their moods were pathological. They were beyond all reason. But reading further back, I find that in the 17th century, goshawks weren't vile at all. They were sociable and familiar, though by nature altogether shy and fearful, wrote Simon Latham in 1615. They take exception at rough and harsh behaviour from the man, but if treated with kindness and consideration, are as loving and fond of her keeper as any other hawk whatsoever. These hawks, too, were talked about as if they were women. They were things to win, to court, to love. But they were not hysterical monsters. They were real, contradictory, self-willed beings, stately and brave, but also shy and fearful. If they behaved in ways that irritated the falconer, it was because he had not treated them well, had not demonstrated continual loving and courteous behaviour towards them. The falconer's role, wrote Edmund Burt, was to provide for all his hawk's needs so that she might have joy in herself. I am her friend, he wrote of his goshawk, and she my playfellow. A more cynical eye might have seen these Elizabethan and Jacobean men as boasting about their hawk training skills, old-school pick-up artists in a bar talking up their seduction routines. But I wasn't cynical. They'd won me over, these long-dead men who loved their hawks. They were reconciled to their otherness, sought to please them and be their friends. I wasn't under any illusion that women were better off in early modern England, and assumed it was a fear of female emancipation that had made goshawks so terribly frightening to later falconers. But even so, I knew which kind of relationship I preferred. I look at Mabel. She looks at me. So much of what she means is made of people. For thousands of years, hawks like her have been caught and trapped and brought into people's houses. But unlike other animals that have lived in such close proximity to man, they have never been domesticated. It's made them a powerful symbol of wildness in myriad cultures, and a symbol, too, of things that need to be mastered and tamed. I close my copy of Burt's Treatise of Hawks and Hawking with a snap, and as the cover falls, my hawk makes a curious, bewitching movement. She twitches her head to one side, then turns it upside down and continues to regard me with the tip of her beak pointing to the ceiling. I'm astonished. I've seen this head turning before. Baby falcons do it when they play. But goshawks? Really? I pull a sheet of paper towards me, tear a long strip from one side, scrunch it into a ball, and offer it to the hawk in my fingers. She grabs it with her beak. It crunches. She likes the sound. She crunches it again, and then lets it drop, turning her head upside down as it hits the floor. I pick it up and offer it to her again. She grabs it and bites it very gently over and over again. Nyam, nyam, nyam. She looks like a glove puppet. A Punch and Judy crocodile. Her eyes are narrowed in bird laughter. I am laughing too. I roll a magazine into a tube and peer at her through it as if it were a telescope. She ducks her head to look at me through the hole. She pushes her beak into it as far as it will go, biting the empty air inside. Putting my mouth to my side of the paper telescope, I boom into it. Hello, Mabel. She pulls her beak free. All the feathers on her forehead are raised. She shakes her tail rapidly from side to side and shivers with happiness. An obscure shame grips me. I had a fixed idea of what a goshawk was, just as those Victorian falconers had, and it was not big enough to hold what goshawks are. No one had ever told me goshawks played. It was not in the books. I had not imagined it was possible. I wondered if it was because no one had ever played with them. The thought made me terribly sad. In a letter to White, Gilbert Blane explained that he didn't like goshawks because their crazy and suspicious temperament had alienated him from them, as it had most Falconers. Perhaps for this reason, White wrote years later, I had loved Goss. I always loved the unteachable, the untouchable, the underdog. Goss was a queer thing, the opposite of civilized English hearts, and through him White could play many selves, the benevolent parent, the innocent child, the kindly teacher, the patient pupil, and other, stranger selves. Through the hawk, White could become a mother, a man who for 2 months had made that bird, almost like a mother nourishing her child inside her. But the subconsciousness of the bird and the man became really linked by a mind's cord to the man who had created out of a part of his life. And in White's notebooks, the ones written in green ink, he begins writing things late at night in a drunken, expansive hand that never make their way into his book because they are too revealing. The thing he most hates is to have his head stroked. The thing he most likes is to have his tail feathers pulled, stroked, pruned, and sorted out. In fact, Goss shows much interest in his backward parts. He is a coprophilite, if not a pansy. He can slice his mutes 3 yards and always turns proudly round to look at them. I, however, who can pee continually for several minutes, and this he supposes to be some form of slicing, excite his interest and envy. There are many ways to read the Goshawk, and one of them is as a work of suppressed homosexual desire, not for flesh, but for blood, for kinship. You can sense it as the book of a lonely man who felt he was different, who was searching for others like him. Falconry wasn't a particularly queer sport, though some of the Falconers White corresponded with, like Jack Mavrogordato and Ronald Stevens, were gay. Perhaps Blaine, too, he never married. But Falconers were a fellowship of men, a monkish elite, a small, tenacious sect, as Lord Tweedsmuir described them, who felt a love that other people did not understand. It was a love that was not considered normal, and it was not something they could help. Gilbert Blane explained that, deeply rooted in the nature of certain individuals, exists some quality which inspires a natural liking for hawks. The true Falconer, he wrote, is born, not made. And in years to come, White would write of how falconry gave him a comforting sense of unspoken fellowship with like-minded men. It was not until I'd kept some hawks by myself that I met another mature falconer and saw his birds and talked to him. Then, for the first time, I found the heart turning over with excitement at the spectacle of falcons in first plumage, found that neither of us needed to complete the grammar of a question or answer. It was a revelation. He saw now that right back to prehistory there had been men like him. I thought it was right that I should now be happy to continue as one of a long line, he wrote, musing on a photograph that showed a carving of an Assyrian falconer from 3,000 years ago. He closed his eyes and imagined reaching back across the centuries to grasp that ancestor's bony hand, in which all the knuckles were as well defined as the nutty calf of his bas-relief leg. To public school men raised on tales of knights and chivalry, the sensation of time-travelling that falconry provoked could be overwhelming. When the countryside writer J. Wentworth Day went hawking with the British Falconers Club in the late 1920s, he wrote that with the marshes at your feet, the wind in your face, the hawk on your fist, you may know that you are for a brief space an heir of the ages. A minor page of history has turned back 1,000 years. Trained hawks have a peculiar ability to conjure history because they are, in a sense, immortal. While individual hawks of different species die, the species themselves remain unchanged. There are no breeds or varieties because hawks were never domesticated. The birds we fly today are identical to those of 5,000 years ago. Civilizations rise and fall, but the hawks stay the same. This gives falconry birds the ability to feel like relics from the distant past. You take a hawk onto your fist, You imagine the falconer of the past doing the same. It is hard not to feel it is the same hawk. I once asked my friend if it ever held things that gave them a spooky sense of history. "Ancient pots with 3,000-year-old thumbprints in the clay," said one. "Antique keys," another. "Clay pipes. Dancing shoes from World War II. Roman coins I found in a field. Old bus tickets and second-hand books." Everyone agreed that what these small things did was strangely intimate. They gave them the sense, as they picked them up and turned them in their fingers, of another person, an unknown person a long time ago, who had held that object in their hands. "You don't know anything about them, but you feel the other person's there," one friend told me. "It's like all the years between you and them disappear, like you become them somehow." History collapses when you hold a hawk, just as it does for my friends with their small and precious objects. The vast differences between you and that long-dead person are forgotten. You cannot help but assume that they saw the world as you see it. And this has troubling ramifications. It is a small step from imagining that you are the same as that long-dead falconer, to presuming that the land you walk upon has been walked upon by people like you since time immemorial. And the ancestors falconers have chosen to imagine tend to have been a cut above the common crowd. "Falconry is certainly of high descent," wrote the falconer, Gay Jell Freeman, in 1859. "Look at the pride, the honest, noble pride of ancestry." When a friend countered this by saying his own love for falconry was perfectly independent of any feeling for antiquity or the Middle Ages, for which he cared nothing, Freeman's response was blunt. "I believe he was mistaken." But hawks did not always grant you communion with lords and earls and kings. At Chapel Green, a hawk let Whitefield part of the community of a pre-Reformation English village. It made him feel at home. "When I was small, I'd loved falconry's historical glamour. I treasured it in the same way children treasure the hope that they might be like the children in books, secretly magical, part of some deeper, mysterious world that makes them something out of the ordinary. But that was a long time ago. I did not feel like that anymore. I was not training a hawk because I wished to feel special. I did not want the hawk to make me feel I was striding righteously across the lands of my long-lost ancestors. I had no use for history, no use for time at all. I was training the hawk to make it all disappear." Tonight, I take Mabel further afield. We get to Midsummer Common at about 8 o'clock, and we wander right across it, past the Redpoll cattle grazing hock-deep in thistles, stop by the cycle path along the south side of the river, and sit ourselves down on a wooden bench under an alder tree. My feet are wet, cold, stinging with thistle scratches. I clench my toes into my sandals and watch the river slide. This side of the bank is all narrowboats and cyclists, but the far bank is fronted with concrete slipways and college boathouses. And on the slipway opposite, a man in a tracksuit is cleaning the bottom of an upended racing boat. Walkers pass, cyclists pass fast, and he and I seem the only people here. The cyclists and shoppers don't see me, they don't see the hawk, and they don't see the man with the boat. I watch him work with his rags and bottles and his yellow bucket. Both he and I are concentrating our attentions on something important. Both of us have a job to do. He has to clean and wax the shell of his boat, and I have to tame the hawk. Nothing else signifies. He wipes and waxes and polishes, and when this has been done to his satisfaction, the boat is shouldered and put back into the boathouse. He packs up the stuff on the slipway and leaves. Mabel doesn't care. She has something much more interesting to attend to, 4 mallards dabbling about in the grey water about 20 yards away. They float off in a little raft, and we make our way home. Now the light is thickening into real dusk, and it starts to rain. And with the rain and the dusk comes the smell of autumn. It makes me shiver happily. But I have no idea what amazement is still to come, because Mabel and I are about to witness an extraordinary phenomenon, an evening ritual I had no idea existed until today. Joggers. Like bats leaving their roost, their numbers build incrementally. First there are one or two, then a gap, then another one, and then three together. By the time Mabel and I are halfway home, it feels as if we're in a nature documentary about the Serengeti. They are everywhere, herds of them. They keep to the paths, though, which is good, because I can position myself and the hawk in a triangle of rough grass and chickweed just after the path splits in two. We stand there in the gloom and watch runners come up, split, and then stream past us. Of course, they don't see us. We are motionless. Perhaps runners are like the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park, I tell her. They can't see things that aren't moving. It is raining quite hard now, and the hawk's flat head is beaded with tiny gems of water that glow in the light from the sodium lamps. She balances on the balls of her feet, as she does when she's calm. Her pupils are wide and cat-like in the dark. What the hell, I think. She's jumped to the fist inside the house. I wonder if she'll do it out here. Right next to us is a wooden barrier enclosing a young lime sapling. I plonk her down on the top of the post, and she jumps, blam, just like that, leash length from the post to my fist for food, with the wind blowing the wrong way, with rain in her eyes, with joggers thundering past us. She jumps three times and then rouses, sending raindrops in a spray of metallic orange around us both. Brilliant. Chapter 13. Alice, Falling. The light is laid evenly on the grass. The cows are back in the fields after milking, and the far sky towards Buckingham builds towards dusk in dinted pewter clouds. Goss is perched 20 yards away on the railings of the well, and White is pleased with himself. He has solved the great and simple mystery of falconry. He knows now that the hawk will fly to him if it is hungry. It will misbehave if it is not. And now he has fashioned a creance from a long length of tarred twine, doubled in two to make it stronger, because it has a tendency to snap, and he has tied it to Goss's swivel. And now he is here, and the hawk is over there, and he is whistling the tune of the hymn that calls the hawk to him. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He rubs his eyes. They have begun to ache. He has been whistling the tune for 10 minutes now, the old Scottish melody to Psalm 23, and it is hard to keep to the right notes when your lips are dry and the mosquitoes are starting to bite. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He does want. He wants very much. He waves the glove again. The jointed rabbit leg waggles. Come on, Goss, come on! He casts the hymn's sad notes once more into the evening air. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Is the hawk looking at him? Surely he is. Why does he not come? He must be patient. The hawk will come. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. For an hour he stands there, sometimes giving up and lying down in the pasture among the cows, then getting up again and waiting for the hawk to fly to him. The hawk does not fly to him. He walks back to 6 yards from the well, holds out his fist and whistles again. Goss stares at him. He does not know what he is expected to do. The man does not know how to teach him. The minutes stretch. Now the waiting is too much to bear. He takes hold of the creance, tugs it. Then he pulls on it, dragging Goss forcibly from his perch. The hawk crashes to the ground, sits there for a few seconds, and flies back up onto the railing. White pulls him down again. And again. And again. On the fourth time, the hawk, defeated, starts wandering about through the thistles towards him. White retreats. The hawk, confused, uncertain, follows. White retreats faster, waving the rabbit leg, and Goss starts to run. Skipping and leaping, fluffed full, a horrible toad, he bounded in my train, White wrote, and the last 2 yards of the 24 were flown to the fist. Later that evening, he rewarded the hawk with a crop of rabbit. The day had been a success, he supposed, of a sort. He's beginning to understand how to bring his hawk into condition. The condition of a hawk, White wrote, was evidently a matter of exquisite assessment, which could only be judged by the Ostringer who knew his hawk, whose subconscious mind was in minutely contact with the subconscious mind of the bird. It was a hard-won revelation, and it was a truth. Looking at Mabel, I can see she's reached her flying weight. It is as obvious to me as a change in the weather. Agitation, nervousness, a tendency to bait from her perch when she was bored, all these are gone at 2 pounds and 1.5 ounces, are replaced by a glassy calm, a flow of perfect attention as if everything inside her were exactly aligned. You won't read the words flying weight in antiquarian falconry books because the old falconers didn't use scales. They assessed the condition of their hawks by feeling their muscles and breastbones and observing their behaviour with sharp and experienced eyes. This is not an easy thing to do, and it is almost impossible for a novice falconer to grasp the subtleties involved in bringing a hawk into flying condition. White had no weighing machine and no mentor to teach him. He had to learn the old methods the hard way. I know that in one sense the weighing of hawks is a falling off, a brute measure compared to the intuitive understanding that comes from really knowing your hawk. Still, I would not train a hawk without a set of scales. When I used to fly merlins, tiny falcons with needle talons and frames so voracious and delicate they resemble heated mice and porcelain, I weighed them 3 times a day. I fussed interminably over the relative calorific value of quail and chicken and mouse. I could tell you how much weight my hawk would lose in an hour, in 2 hours, in 3. Even an 1/8 of an ounce would make a difference to how my merlins flew. It is a grosser calculation with a goshawk because Mabel is huge compared to a merlin. But still, it is not easy to judge how much food and of what kind will bring her into perfect flying condition. Scraps of paper litter the kitchen table, jotted with weights and question marks. I am convinced I have these calculations pat, and I am out to prove it. At 4 o'clock, we set off for my college cricket pitch and her first calling-off lessons. It'll be fine, Mabel. It's a long vacation. The place will be deserted. No dogs, no cows, no people. No one will bother us there. We stand uncertainly under the thatched roof of the pavilion. Behind us is a straggling copse of chestnut and limes, and a ditch full of leaves and rainwater. The air about us is mild, still, pointed with tiny flies, the sky dull and flat as unpolished brass. There's an ill savour to the air. I am not sure I want to be here. On the other side of the pitch is a familiar building, a red brick Victorian Camelot with crenellated battlements, mullioned windows and a tiny Gothic tower. My office is up there on the top floor. Books, papers, a desk, a chair, a carpet of dove-coloured wool, air that always smells of sun-baked dust, even in winter when frost burns the glass and makes drop shadows on the panes. I look at the blank façade and think of the letter I'd sent that morning to a German university telling them I couldn't accept the job they'd offered me that winter. I told them I was sorry, told them that my father had died and I needed to be here. But I was not sorry, and they were not the reasons for my refusal. I can't go to Berlin in December, I thought, appalled. I have a hawk to fly. Ambitions, life plans, these were for other people. I could no more imagine the future than a hawk could. I didn't need a career. I didn't want one. White doves fly up from the roof. I watch their wings flicker against the sky. Sudden vertigo. Something shifts in my head. Something huge. Then everything I see collapses into something else. I blink. It looks the same, but it isn't. This is not my college. Nothing about it feels familiar. It doesn't even feel like a college at all. Just a few acres of buildings, giant collector's boxes of brick and stone crammed with the detritus of centuries. In the chapel are painted angels whose faces are all the same, uncanny angels with swords and bright Pre-Raphaelite plumage. There's a bronze Benin cockerel in the dining hall, and a skeleton in a cupboard in the fellow's cloakroom, a real yellowed skeleton held together with pins and twisted wire. Beyond my office building are a host of yew trees clipped into absurd wind-blown boulders, a bronze horse on one lawn, and a hare on the other, and a metal book held to the ground by a sculpted ball and chain. Everything here is built from things pulled from dreams. A few weeks earlier, scores of bay trees in pots were set out all over the college for an Alice in Wonderland-themed ball. I'd watched students wiring flowers into their branches, soft fabric roses of white and pillarbox red. In 2 months, I think, my college job will end. In 2 months, I will have no office, no college, no salary, no home. Everything will be different. But, I think, everything already is. When Alice dropped down the rabbit hole into Wonderland, she fell so slowly she could take things from the cupboards and bookshelves on the walls, look curiously at the maps and pictures that passed her by. In my 3 years as a Cambridge Fellow, there'd been lectures and libraries and college meetings, supervisions, admissions interviews, late nights of paper writing and essay marking and other things soaked in Canterbridgean glamour, eating pheasant by candlelight at high table while snow dashed itself in flurries against the leaded glass and carols were sung and the port was passed and the silver glittered upon dark polished refectory tables. Now, standing on a cricket pitch with a hawk on my hand, I knew I had always been falling as I moved past these things. I could reach out and touch them, pick them off their shelves and replace them, but they were not mine. Not really ever mine. Alice, falling, looked down to see where she was headed, but everything below her was darkness. Concentrate on why you're here, I tell myself. You have a hawk to fly. Ever since my father died, I'd had these bouts of derealization, strange episodes where the world became unrecognizable. It will pass. But I am spooked by what's just happened. My fingers shake as I thread the end of the crayon through the swivel at the end of her jesses and tie it there with two miniature falconer's knots. I pull on them, and they hold. Knots and lines, material reassurances. I play out 15 feet more creance and stow the rest of it deep in a zipped-up pocket of my hawking waistcoat to keep it secure. Then I pull her leash free from the swivel and tuck it into another pocket. Hawking waistcoats like those of fishermen or photographers are hardly clothes at all, just pockets hung in rows. The one at my right hip is lined in vinyl, and inside it are 3 dead day-old chicks, each skinned and torn roughly in half. Sit there. On you go. The hawk hops onto the rail of the wooden veranda and turns to face me in a low boxer's crouch. I step back 6 feet, put half a chick in my glove, extend my arm and whistle. There is no hesitation. There is a scratch of talons on wood, a flowering of feathers, one deep downstroke, the brief, heavy swing of talons brought up and into play, and the dull thud as she hits my glove. When she's finished eating, we do it again, and this time I stand a little further away. 8 feet, 3 wing beats, another reward. For a creature with the tactical intelligence of a goshawk, this game is child's play. The third time I put her on the railing, she is already airborne as I turn my back. A skip of my heart, a hastily extended glove, and she is at my side, wolfing down the rest of her food, crest raised, wings dropped, eyes blazing, a thing of perfect triumph. I thread her leash back through the swivel and untie the crayons. That will do for today. She flew perfectly. And I'm so pleased with how the lesson has gone, I start singing on the way home. I serenade my hawk with my favourite things, with whiskers and kittens and brown paper packages tied up with string. It strikes me that this must be happiness, that I've remembered what it is and how it can be done. But watching television from the sofa later that evening, I noticed tears running from my eyes and dropping into my mug of tea. Odd, I think. I put it down to tiredness. Perhaps I'm getting a cold. Perhaps I'm allergic to something. I wipe the tears away and go to make more tea in the kitchen, where a dead white rabbit is defrosting like a soft toy in an evidence bag, and the strip light flickers ominously, undecided whether to illuminate the room or cease working entirely. These calling-off lessons teach the hawk to fly immediately to an upraised glove and a whistle. Rapid response is the key to success. If the hawk doesn't come straight away, there's no point in waiting minutes on end whistling and calling. It's better to end the training session and try again later. White did not know this, and it is one of the reasons why his first attempt to call Goss is so painful to read. But what upset me most about that sorry episode wasn't the weight that taught the hawk nothing, nor the sadistic tug on the crayons that pitched poor Goss to the ground. It wasn't even that he'd taken so long to reward the hawk that it had no understanding that the food it was given was a reward at all. It was this, that once the hawk decided to walk towards him, White had run away. But he returns and tries again. 2 days later, Goss is back on the railings and White is 40 yards away, whistling and waving 2 ounces of butcher's steak in his hand. He pleads. He calls. He tries every voice he knows. His tone is commanding, pandering, urgent, mad, soft, desperate, cross. "Now, now," he remonstrates. "Don't be silly. Come along. Be a good Goss. Gossy, gossy, Goss." After 10 minutes, Goss decides to fly. But the falconer's joy turns fast to horror, for what is approaching him is hardly a hawk at all. It is a humpbacked, aviating Richard III, a ghastly aerial toad, and its glowing headlamp eyes are not focused on his outstretched fist, my God, but on his exposed and unprotected face. He begins to panic. Goss had hurt him a few minutes before, had jumped up to his shoulder and buried a foot in his neck. There was blood. There was a great deal of pain. He remembers the force of that blow, the agony of it, the reserves of patience it required for him not to dash the hawk to the ground and kill it, to wait, just to wait for the hawk to let go. Closer. Now it is 5 paces. It is almost upon him. Those great eyes are fixed on his. "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil." He cannot bear it. His nerve breaks. He shuts his eyes and ducks. Goss, vastly confused, veers off into the branches of a tree, misses his footing, drops awkwardly into a hedge. White collects himself, retrieves the hawk, walks back to the railings and tries the whole lesson again. This time he will be brave. This time. As the hawk flies to him, he holds his breath and tries to stand his ground. I brace the breast muscles not to flinch. It was too much. At 2 yards, humanity became again the inherent coward, and cringed away to the right, averting face from the eyes of slaughter, humping shoulder, powerless to remain erect. But Goss, bound to the shoulder with a decisive blow, stepped quickly down the arm, was feeding on 2 ounces of beef. He had tried so hard not to be a coward. It was why he had hunted with the Grafton and learned to fly, and why he had swum around the St. Leonard's Pier when he was small and dived off the highest diving board at the Hastings Baths at school. He feels that old sick horror. Powerless to remain erect, he must be brave. When he was small, his mother had pleaded with him that he should grow up a big, brave, and honourable man, and it had conditioned him to fear the reverse. "I felt myself incapable of being any of these noble things," he'd written. This was a test of manhood. Screwing his courage tight, he calls Goss once more, from 50 yards this time, and this time he does not duck, even with terror flowing in all the courses of his veins. He is proud of the hawk for flying 50 yards, proud of himself for standing his ground. It is a victory worthy of celebration, and that night he drinks himself senseless. "I cry, Prosit, loudly and repeatedly," he wrote, "quaff fiery liquids of triumph, drink damnation to my enemies, and smash the glasses on the floor." It is 15 days since the hawk arrived. I've washed my hair, applied some makeup, found some presentable clothes, that is, ones not dusted with dried hawk mutes, and walked with Mabel to my college for a summer lunch party at the Master's Lodge. At 2:10, I'm sitting at a long table on a secluded English lawn, giving an impromptu lecture on falconry while Mabel tears at a rabbit leg in my hand. The master of the college, a shrewd and genial man in an impeccably tailored suit, is listening intently to my speech. Next to him is his mother, looking distinctly amused. Her grandchildren sit by her. And next to them, the master's wife, an elegant, dark-haired lawyer holding a glass of wine. She catches my eye and grins. 2 days ago, on the way to the supermarket, I'd heard her shout my name and turned to see her dismount from her bicycle with practiced equestrian grace. We talked for a while under tattered leaf shadows, and soon I was in the kitchen of the master's lodge drinking tea. "So, Helen," she said, "we're having a lunch party on Saturday. Just family. In the garden, if the weather's fine. What would be marvellous," she said, head tilted, "would be if you came along afterwards and brought your hawk. We've heard you're flying her on the college grounds, and we'd love to meet her." She uncapped a black marker pen, wrote, "Helen, Goshawk," on a whiteboard, then hesitated, turned to me. "2 p.m.? 2 p.m. She wrote the time in her elegant hand and smiled. So now the hawk eats. The conversation continues. The sun falls in pale plains on the ancient walls. The chirrups of house martins drift down from above like distant fingertips on glass, and I glory in it all. How beautiful it is here, I think, and how supremely unlikely it is that I ever got to be here at all. A state school kid, born to parents who'd never gone to university, to whom Cambridge was the mysterious haunt of toffs and spies.
"You must be a spy," my father used to tell me. "Must be."
He'd watched me as a child sneaking about with binoculars, hiding for hours in bushes and trees. I was the invisible girl, someone tailor-made for a secret life. "No, really, I'm not," I'd say for the 100th time. "I'm not."
"Well, of course you'd say that."
And he'd laugh delightedly, because there was no way I could persuade him otherwise. "It's a job, Dad," I'd say, rolling my eyes. "I teach people English and the history of science. I sit in a library, read books, do my research. That's all it is. I'm not something out of a John le Carré novel."
"But you could be," he'd say, stressing the could, and part of him not joking at all.
My father had revelled in the thought that I might be a spy. for it was a life he understood, being only a hair's breadth from his own. One day he'd handed me a miniature silver camera. "It takes special film," he said gleefully, flipping open the back and showing me where the miniature spool fitted.